From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 262, recorded live Thursday, April 14th, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Sam Saffron and Rob Connery about their micro ORMs.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm here at the lovely Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino in the Hansel Suite, and I've got Sam Saffron from Stack Overflow and Rob Connery all the way from Hawaii. How's it going, guys?
Excellent.
Fantastic. How are you, Rob?
I'm doing really good. How are you?
Lovely, lovely, lovely. So, micro ORMs. Sam, you kind of started a little bit of a firestorm when you read a really, really cool, interesting blog post on Perf of object relational mappers. And then a couple of weeks earlier, I know that Rob created a tiny ORM called Massive and did a series of blog posts in which he basically refactored by deleting code. What is a micro ORM, and how does it relate to something like EF or Link to SQL?
I guess we kind of coined the same term. The idea is an ORM that does a lot less work. So usually you're used to having every feature imaginable inside an ORM, and they just keep on adding and adding with the versions. The idea with the micro ORMs is to stick to a small subset of what an ORM does and do it really well and really fast.
Now, isn't an ORM supposed to abstract away the database and all of, and hide everything in the database? Isn't it supposed to protect me from SQL that I could hurt myself with?
Yes, it is. But also you lose a large amount of control by doing that. If you are trying to like hide all of the work that you want to do and ever need to do anything slightly tricky, you will not know how to do it. And also like the abstractions leak. So you leak performance, you leak complexity. Certain things become simpler, but also other things can become more complicated. By talking SQL, you don't have to translate all of these expressions into another language. So you know just one language, which is the language the database talks.
I remember when I started working with my first ORM, the database people started to become really uncomfortable. And they're uncomfortable because suddenly they're not in control. But I think they also kind of feared for their jobs. But I'm hearing you say that if you use these ORMs in the kind of the classic big object relational mappers that hide everything, and you don't know what's going on, you're going to kind of get yourself in trouble. Are you saying that we need to know the full stack? I mean, with MVC and things like it, we're supposed to know HTTP and we're supposed to know HTML and JavaScript, and now you're asking me to know all about how cardinality works and left, inner, outer join, whatever, whatever. This is a lot of work. I don't know if I have enough brain cells to hold all that information.
That's an interesting question. I think look at like a trivial example. You want to write a little Windows Forms app, and you want to have a little embedded database. You have one little table, which is your your invoice table, storing invoices in there. All you really need to do here is pull in SQL CE or something, and execute three different queries on it to get all of your data in, to select the data, to delete the data. There's no need for like years of work that was put into an ORM to do that. Mm-hmm. If you had to code it manually, you could do that with SQL data readers. But then there's a lot of code that you write, which is tedious, that you're tired of writing. You've written it like 1,000 times. You don't want to write it again. But by using an ORM for this particular case, I mean, all you need to learn is like three different SQL constructs and you're set. You're not, it's not like you have to learn every little bit of thing about the database for like this trivial example.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that, man up. You're basically saying I shouldn't, be complaining. And then there's not that much to learn. SQL's not as scary.
Yeah.
As you think it is.
Something that I've discovered too is that there's a contradiction between someone who says, I don't want SQL. You know, I don't want to write SQL.
Right.
Those are usually the same people that say, get your designer out of my face. I want to write my own HTML. And, you know, we've talked so many times about abstraction and how much abstraction do we need and should I really be able to get in there? And with SQL, I think yes. I think it's one of the most important things you can do. And I always, it's kind of been my cause, if you will, that SQL is the best DSL for working with a database that you can possibly have. And,
a DSL is a domain-specific language.
Domain-specific language. And you need to do the things you need to do. Just embrace the SQL. Now, that said, a certain amount of abstraction, you know, you don't want to, as Sam was saying, write insert statements and updates, deletes all the time. So you can abstract a little bit. But knowing what's going on underneath is critically important. And for instance, like in the enterprise, you just talked about this. If you use a tool like Entity Framework or in Hibernate, and you don't really know what you're doing, you're a junior dev, you've set it all up, and you're working against a hyper-normalized database, let's say a big, massive enterprise system, and you start using Entity Framework, stitching together these link calls, you have no idea the oatmeal SQL that's generated. And next thing you know, the DBA is knocking on your door. What are you doing to my database with this tool?
Right. And then they want you to use stored procs. And the stored procs are the database person's way of telling you stop doing that.
Exactly right.
And I know that a lot of database administrators and databases that I've worked on in large enterprises, they wouldn't allow arbitrary SQL. Like if you want something, you put in a change request and you ask for a stored proc and they go off and they write it for you and they call you in a week when it's done.
It's interesting that you mentioned stored procs because that's like back to the world of these micro RMs. What do you need for stored procs? Like you're just making a simple call and you're getting a record set back. There's no magic going on there. If you want to update, you have to call the stored proc with all the parameters and send it in there. You don't have any of, so using something like Entity Framework for like a project that is purely stored procs doesn't even make sense.
But weren't there two arguments for stored procs? One was they're faster. That was an argument. And the second one was that you never know if your database tables might change or rename or columns move around, but the stored proc was an interface that you could somehow count on. I think that's what people would say.
I think it's a bit of a lie. I think what the real reason is that when there is push for stored procs is that the DBAs want control. They don't want to let you mess up their database. And by taking the stored procs and owning them, they're not worried what these silly developers are going to do. But I think if you did man up earlier and learn SQL, and was able to like structure some of these queries and started thinking in sets and not just iteratively like a lot of programmers do, which is like a very, very common issue that people are just, you know, I know how to do a loop from 1 to 10 and you don't think, yeah, well, I'm in SQL now. I need to work in a set. That's the efficient way of working. So once you've had that shift and you understand how to deal with it, it becomes a lot easier. And then the DBAs respect you more and allow you to work against their database.
What do you think, Rob? Sorry, you look like you had you're deep in thought and maybe you had fallen asleep.
No, I wasn't falling asleep. I was just thinking about the DBAs out there specifically.
But what are they going to do?
Well, they like it without the abstraction. You know, I had a DBA look at Massive and I said, what do you think? Am I nuts? You know, and, it was a good friend of mine, Rob Sullivan, and he looked at this and he said, I just love you. Thank you so much. I'm not having to do. And he just started spazzing out and he started looking at the way I was sending in parameters. And
so why did he like that? Because Rob Sullivan is a hardcore DBA. Yeah. He's a guy who tends his SQL tables as one would tend their garden.
He liked it because he was able to get into the nitty gritty system SQL client stuff, the add parameters and make sure that the length in the string call was 4,000. So it optimized the plans. So I didn't write SQL that blew up his indexes and on and on and on. And, you know, he could actually proof the SQL in the code.
Okay.
Or send me a block of SQL or just say run this SP. Either way, the communication between my code, database, Rob, and everything just was streamlined. It's no longer like, well, how do I get Entity Framework to not use an in, you know, in this thing and use the proper
jump? How do I flip? You know, it's like when someone gives you a bunch of lights, they give you a bunch of switches, and then you figure out which switch turns on which light. Right. But here's the question I want to understand. And I know you're an incredibly old man, Rob, and I am also of advanced age, and I've been doing this almost 20 years. Did we as a group, as a career go insane for the last 15 years? Because I'm hearing all of these people I respect, these what I call alpha geeks, reveling in inline inline scripting things like web pages and PHP and reveling in select star from episodes sitting right there next to JavaScript and HTML and talking about how refreshing and clean it is. But in 1995, when we were doing the exact same thing, we were like, oh, it's hell on earth. What are we doing? Oh my God. I mean, we are writing the same stuff that I thought was crap in 1995, in 2011. Is this just an example of we're all going to end up writing Lisp in the future anyway? Or did we have some kind of break? You know, was it really, was the last 15 years, did it really happen?
I think that users are finally catching up. And what that means is in the beginning, in the, you know, the web and the internet, it was mostly geeks like us, right? And we don't really care. Times New Roman is fine. And, you know, you go to a message board and there's a box, you type into it. And so now it seems like the web is, of course, the web. Users like my mom are on Facebook and they expect things to look and act a certain way. The people that pay attention to that are the ones that say, you and your architecture and all your, I don't care, get it done. And it's the people that can get it done that are able to make this really compelling designs for users, get it out there, thinking user first. You don't think software first. I think that's responsible for a lot of this, to be honest.
So you're saying that the get her done attitude is what's moving us away from these large systems? Mm-hmm. What was moving us towards them? We were all reading Fowler and all of these mm-hmm. different people and building large systems for years mm-hmm. and years and years. I was paid to whiteboard for money when I was doing consultancies, and I was explaining how to build large object-oriented systems. And they worked, and they were successful, but yeah. Are you telling me they're just not necessary?
Well, think about MSDN, not to pick on Mike, or the ASP.NET site, right, that just went through a great redesign.
Right, we use Umbraco now on ASP.NET.
If you can, in a single sentence, describe the difference between ASP.NET, let's say 5 years ago and today, what would that sentence be? I mean, it would be less. More organized.
Yeah, less is more.
And it's a user-defined experience. Before, it was just basically right. A bunch of, like,
but
a wall of text.
But how does that take me to saying that a single file with inline SQL and JavaScript and HTML is better than controls and data grids and data sources and abstraction layers?
For me, the user experience, again, to come back to ASP.NET site, someone sat down and thought about what is my reader going to do and how are they going to get to the information rather mm-hmm. than, well, me as an engineer, I think we should display links over here in these 12,000 ads and whatnot. Thought about the user first. And so to bring it back to your point, sometimes that simplicity, mental simplicity of taking all the cruft out of your brain, thinking about the user makes you develop a compelling experience. Because if it takes you a circuitous route to build that user's experience, you're going to get fatigued. You're going to say, oh, just throw a list box on the page. I don't, you know, it doesn't need to do a drop down.
Okay. What do you think, Sam? Is this just a, you're not going to need it? Just Yagni has caught up with us a decade later?
I don't think it's mutually exclusive. I think these systems can coexist. And, for some things, there are some problems that, like, having a slightly more complicated abstraction is really handy. If you need to, like, cut through results in all sorts of weird ways. So, you've got to display a list of things and you have to order it by this or by that and you have to filter it by this or by that. You're stuck composing these fairly complex things.
Mm-hmm.
I think something that happened is that because these big, big systems solved this one complicated problem and also solved another 1,000 problems, we were stuck using this big, complicated system. What I'm hoping is that we'll be able to, like, reduce this down and build a smaller piece that does capture all of those common issues that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So back to, like, your original thing. I mean, were we sleeping for the last 15 years and did we make a huge mistake? No, I don't think so. I think we learned a lot. But I think once in a while, we have to go back to basics and try and figure out what really is happening. We want to know. We don't want to be, sitting there blind to these huge systems that people are throwing at. We want to be able to debug down to the lines that are sending commands to the database and figure out what is going on.
Hi, this is Scott coming to you from another place in time. Are you using agile practices to manage your software development? There's lots of tools in the market that manage the steps of a project, but most of them focus on individual roles. Get ready for a solution that caters for the success of the whole team. The guys at Telerik introduced TeamPulse. It's an agile project management tool that'll help you gather ideas, estimate, plan, track progress in a common workspace. Finally, companies, regardless of their size, can use a lightweight and convenient tool that makes all the stakeholders work as a united team, even if they're in different countries. By combining intuitive user interface and the power of Silverlight, Team Pulse removes the roadblocks that you typically face in applying Agile in an effective manner. No more lost data, no disparate systems, no lack of critical analytics regarding the health and velocity of your project. See for yourself, get a free copy for 5 users and 1 project at Telerik.com/Team Pulse. And please do thank Telerik for supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page, facebook.com/TELERIK, Telerik. We do appreciate it. There wouldn't be a Hansel Minutes if there wasn't Telerik helping us. So what I'm hearing you say is that it's not that we are saying the last 10 years was a mistake, but we are hearkening back to a simpler time, and we are saying that, you know, sometimes you need a power drill and sometimes you do it the old-fashioned way, the way our ancestors did in the early 90s. Like, there is time when you do it the simple, close to the metal way, and then there's also a place for the larger things, and perhaps mix and matching when the tools are appropriate.
I was just thinking that it also follows a very natural pattern of complexity resolving to simplicity, which is blasting out to complexity. It's like butterfly wings and hurricane and all that stuff, where you do get to a point and all of a sudden everything resolves. And an image popped in my head. Do you remember when BMW, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, they came out with a new 7 Series and they did away with all the instrumentation. And you think about these cars that, you know, were the technical aspect of these cars, 4 or 5, and maybe longer years ago, dashboard covered in instrumentation. And it was kind of a calling card. Like, look how technical and cool and lit up and blinky our car is. And BMW came out with a single knob, and the single knob had a screen, and you page through and you click, click. And it's like, you know, the iPhone's interface too. I think people are moving to embrace this simple technology. I think they like it.
So in the embracing of that, you, Sam, work at Stack Overflow, mm-hmm. and I know that you're really big on the perf. Perf is kind of one of the things you're known for,
yeah.
at least that I know you for. And Stack Overflow has, I think, 40 or so tables, and they use Link to SQL for a very long time. It was all originally done in Link to SQL.
Mm-hmm.
And you found some hotspots that you didn't like, and Link to SQL was getting in your way. So
yes.
What did you do about it?
So the first step with any performance issues is figuring out that you have a performance issue and where it is. So like you said, you found hotspots, but that takes a long time to discover what they are. Once we discovered the hotspots, there are two things that you do. One is you try to make less database calls if you can. So if we had a page that was doing 60 database calls and we pare it down to 20, suddenly there's a lot less round trips to the database. And a lot less ORM work because suddenly it's only doing, you know, 20 calls. And once you pare that down, then you continue to see, well, you know, is this fast enough? Am I happy with it? And, for a couple of our really hot areas, we weren't happy with it. And then we just went and hand coded them. But we already had them hand coded before. The trouble was that we needed to be able to tell how this reader was being constructed. We need to know the pipeline between my abstraction to where the database is executing. We needed to know what that pipeline was doing and be able to control it. So that's when we stepped in with Dapper and replaced bits.
Okay, so to give folks that are listening a little bit more context, right? Link to SQL is a one-to-one mapper between an object in a C# object maps directly to a table. And it's a reasonably lightweight layer, but it gives you objects when you do reads, and it expects you to create objects and do inserts. And when you say that you went kind of lower down, are you talking about, like, you know, DB connection, SQL client, and database readers and things like that?
Well, actually, yes. At some point, we had some hotspots initially where we just said, no, we can't take this anymore. We need to, like, write the SQL data reader. And it was, like, back to 20 years ago when you were sitting with SQL data readers and praying that you get the numbers for the columns right, because if you shift by one, then everything is going to explode. And if somebody adds a column, everything's going to explode. So that code is incredibly fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And then we looked and said, look, you know, we can create an abstraction that is simple, lightweight, and replace that code with it and not lose much perf. And that is when, like, we introduced our micro ORM.
So your micro ORM, I would, if I, come back to the select star from something.
Yeah.
What do I write? If I'm going to, like, in the keynote at Mix here, I wrote, using web matrix, database.open, and then I went query select star from episodes. And then what came out of my stuff was a dynamic object that was generated by, the web matrix magic. How would that work in Dapper? What is happening under the covers?
So what we do in Dapper is, it's a generic method. So you tell it that it's of type post and it returns a list of posts. So we fortunately had post already defined for link to SQL, so we can reuse the object.
Mm-hmm.
So it's identical to the line that you described, except that it has a generic parameter. Now, underneath, what it does is it performs some very, very heavy caching. So it will generate methods that will read the parameters. Actually, I'll go back one step with that. We'd pass the parameter, let's say, we want to select star from post where post ID equals one. You're not going to hard code that string 1,000 times because it's not going to be cached. It's not going to, SQL Server is not going to be able to cache that query. So instead you parameterize it, and we parameterize it. We put, at ID. We pass in an anonymous method saying ID equals one. And then we're able to cache the, piece of code that is able to read that parameter and turn it into a SQL command and SQL parameters. That's part one of the code that we're caching, that we're generating on the fly. And the second part of code that we'll cache is the code that will take the SQL data reader and new upper post and set every property one at a time, depending on what the data reader came back.
Mm-hmm.
And this is done dynamically. So if you add a column later on, you've done select star, you add a column later on in the database and you add it again in your posts class, mm-hmm. it will pick that up on the next run.
And many of us have written naive implementations of data reader to object that use reflection and different things like that. But since you're really interested in perf, you're actually emitting these methods, these almost deserializers, a collection of different deserializers that say, here's the object post, or in my example episodes, that is the shape of the data reader. And I know that this column thing this, and this object has that property. So rather than reflecting around, which would be horrifically slow, you're actually emitting IL.
Yeah.
And saying, here's a little, just for this app domain's lifetime,
mm-hmm.
little deserializer.
Yes.
And it goes left hand, right hand. Data reader at zero goes in here. Da, 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 da.
Correct. Exactly like that. And there are two techniques. These techniques existed back from .NET 1.
Mm-hmm.
Reflection emit was there. But it became incredibly efficient in .NET 2 when they introduced lightweight code gen. And that allows you to define static methods that can bypass visibility checks on mm-hmm. objects, so you can even hydrate private properties and so on. In .NET 4, with the dynamic movement, there's a new way of doing this with expressions that allows you to build IL in expressions.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble with lightweight code gen is it's both a blessing and a curse, is that it is very, very close to the metal. So you can very, very easily mess up. If you make a bug there's no debugging. It explodes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you make one wrong MSIL statement, the next thing you know, you've destabilized the runtime. That's the error you get.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot debug into it. Microsoft introduced expressions in .NET 3.5 and beefed it up in .NET 4 to allow you to do a lot of this.
Probably, so you found it to be fairly straightforward thing to build.
We used IL we used it because we're used to it.
Right.
Mark and I both are much more comfortable in it. Also, it'll allow Dapper to work in .NET 2.0 later on if we want to.
And how big is this? How many lines of code is this? Is Dapper?
A couple hundred
lines. So this is really interesting. So here's a person optimizing for performance, and you found a solution by which you would say, you know, I have an object. Here's some SQL. Make it happen. And you optimize for performance and you found happiness. Now, Rob is always optimizing for happiness. Right? And
okay.
So you simultaneously and unbeknownst to Sam are off trying to figure out how to make things prettier. You've been working in Web Matrix and you are also a Rubyist on occasion. When you tried to optimize for happiness, you came up with something called Massive.
Right.
How did that happen and why did you do it?
Well, I was working with webmatrix.data a lot with our podcast site that we have, the other one, and just a few other adventures. And it was really fun, but there's a few things that were missing. And as we talked about before, there's certain things with SQL that are not fun. Insert into value, you end up writing a lot of stuff. WebMatrix.data doesn't support that right now. And I thought, well, maybe I could just write a little bit of love for this thing. And I started to put some ideas together. And I thought, well, you know, I could just make it a method call. Or what if I just send in an anonymous object and deserialize that into a SQL call? I did that. It worked. And then I thought, well, what if I did it with a dictionary? What if I did it with a name value collection? What if I did it with an expand or a dynamic and all this stuff? And it was really easy with all the language enhancements in C# 4. So for me, you know, I was telling somebody yesterday that I think 25% of the whole massive thing is the reading out of the database, or excuse me, it is the actual inserts and updates. The rest of it is the reading of the data. The putting in of data and the updating of data, deleting it, and so on was actually quite simple. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, well, I don't really need to base this on webmatrix.data. Mm-hmm. Let's go down a level.
So you had built it on webmatrix.data.
I did. I started out on webmatrix.data and I thought, well, it doesn't do transactions the way I would expect. There's a few things that I want in there for performance. And so I just went to system data common, mm-hmm. which uses data factory. And now we can open it up to all providers. And I did that and I started squeezing code down. And that became for me, for some reason, the fun part of it all. Let's see how small I can make this. And it started out at 500 lines. I trimmed it down to 450. Then someone from the community came in, refactored a bunch of my mess, you know, out, squeezed it down to 360, and then we've hovered around 360 for a while.
And when you say squishing it down lines, you're literally talking about semantics. You're not talking about just removing white space and making everything really long lines.
Yeah, refactoring, using some better expression syntax. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you kind of wrote a poem, basically. I mean, massive is almost like, you know, it's a haiku, it's a big haiku. I mean, you optimized first for usefulness and happiness, and then you started to optimize because it became a challenge to make it really small.
Yeah.
And Sam is using Reflection Emit, and he's bringing out real objects, a real right. post or a real episode.
Yeah.
When I use massive, what do I get out of my my execute call?
Currently, it's what's called an expando object, a dynamic object in .NET, and you can assign a property to it, read a property from it. It's kind of a willy-nilly Play-Doh, so to speak. But a lot of people have been asking for a generic to be used. You could do a query mm-hmm. of T. And I was thinking about it, and it's just a couple of lines of reflection. And, you know, it's so funny. I was thinking about doing this. The problem is that you get into type conversion when you're starting to do reflection. What's coming out of the database might not necessarily match exactly the type. And I keep thinking, I want to do it, but then, oh man, this is going to open up big.
But isn't it already done? You're sitting next to it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I did it with Subsonic, and people have done it, you know, mm-hmm. in the past, but.
Should you merge the two? Should Massive and Dapper become Massively Dapper?
I am not nearly as smart as Sam.
Well, but the point is, though, is there one library here or two, I think is the question.
Well, Sam's is purpose-driven, which I think is great. He did it for performance, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I'm not saying there's a difference in vision, mm-hmm. but, you know, I didn't even know an IL writer existed mm-hmm. until I saw this code. My eyes crossed. And we had a great time on Twitter. You know, Jeff Atwood came out and said, oh, we're squeezing your head. We're coming after you and your lines of code. Mm-hmm. And I looked at Dapper and I saw the perf thing. And I'm like, wait, how could they double up my, you know, because they were twice as fast as massive. And mm-hmm. so I got to going back and forth with Sam and emailed. And he's like, well, allow for a connection to be passed in that's already open. Mm-hmm. Oh, duh, I should have done that before. Led me to refactor down by 40 lines, and then I added in an overload. And,
right.
And so, yeah, there, we matched up now on some calls. They're still faster.
Are there any examples where you have 4 or 5 lines of code that was written entirely separately but ended up being the way to do it? Or are they entirely different and unique implementations that just happen to have similar signatures and similar perf?
I think it's like when I added the dynamic piece to Dapper after massive just to try and like have parity there. Also internally, we use that quite often that we don't want to like create a class. It's mm-hmm. a little bit annoying to go through all of that code. So it's easier just to take a dynamic back. But I think we came to the same conclusion like independently of, you know, it's pretty simple. You know, you build up an expando, set up all those things on it.
Yeah.
And I think one of the big differences between Dapper and Massive is the way that we pass parameters in. I guess for us, like we needed to be able to pass in big chunks of SQL with lots of intertwined parameters and be able to tell which one is which. Mm-hmm. Whereas I guess Massive is not dealing as much with that problem. It's trying to be something a lot leaner. But I guess we'll pick up things from each framework as they meet what we need to do with it. And I'd be happy to like take little classes from Rob, and I'm sure he'd be happy the other way around.
So both of these, Dapper and Massive, are both in NuGet, and that's probably the best way to get them. And I think you're both on GitHub.
Yeah.
What do you tell the, there's this canonical person out there. I don't know if they exist or not, but I always talk about the chief architect of the Nebraska Department of Forestry, right? He's working in a big enterprise. He's out in the middle of maybe not quite New York, and he's got a lot of legacy stuff, and he's trying to get up on the new stuff, but, you know, he wants to use things like Dapper and Massive, but maybe he's got Linked to SQL, or maybe he's got nHibernate. What do you tell that person?
I tell him, what is your problem? What are your pain points at the moment? I don't tell him, look, there's something shiny and new that is fast and is awesome. Use it. I tell him, look, this is the other options that you have that are out there. If you have a particular performance bottleneck and your web servers are running hot because of your ORM, then these are your options. One thing that I think I did with Dapper, which is really important, was a very, very good benchmark that measures what the ORM cost is. Mm-hmm. And now we have nHibernate in it, Linked to SQL, Entity Framework. I'm accepting patches to add more and more. There's a very similar implementation of what Dapper did called Peter Poco that also does something similar. I tell this guy to figure out what it is that he needs to solve.
Right.
And I inform him that these other Lego pieces exist.
You know, for me, the interesting thing about Massive is I don't, if I'm talking to Mr. Nebraska Department of Forestry, you know, it's not that I think it's going to necessarily change a lot of what they're doing right now. Like, if you use this tool, you'll have, you know, splendid happiness all your life long. What I think people have found is just by playing with it, they're able to see some of the new things that are in system.dynamic or in C# 4. Like, oh, wow, I didn't think you could do this. Hey, maybe we can go ahead and take this approach.
Right.
And in a way, I've found a lot of people have come back and said, I really like Massive, but what we decided to do is X, Y, Z. And I'm like, great, go for it. You know, I mean.
So it is different, though, than 15 years ago. I mean,
much.
Dynamics and lambdas and expressions and ILMIT, it's not classic ASP all over again, is it?
No. No, and that's, you know, to come back to your thing, are we going backwards? I don't think so. I think we're going forwards because we, you know, the complexity is resolving now into these frameworks are so capable and there's a lot more functionality in them. And we're able to take that extreme amount of functionality and resolve it into something that's simple, which I think is elegant and wonderful.
Very cool. Well, you can check out Massive on GitHub and on NuGet and Rob's blog. And you can also learn more about Dapper at Sam's blog and on NuGet.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.